of us have behaviors, and our kids particularly have more behaviors than language that tells the story. And what I want all of us to really think about is, let's notice the behaviors. Let's know they tell a story. There's something about the behaviors, but let's don't focus on the behaviors. And we talked about this in the first episode, so I encourage you to go back and listen to it, because we talked about it more in depth. But really, again, who our neurodivergent individuals are is amazing and unique and strong and creative and courageous and funny and resourceful, and they want to be connected.
Hello, I'm Cassie Gillespie, and you're listening to The Social Work Lens. The Social Work Lens is a podcast produced by the University of Vermont's Child Welfare Training Partnership and the State of Vermont. This is the second part in a three-part series on the triple intersection between trauma, neurodiversity, and gender diversity. Today, we'll be talking with Kelly Smith, and we'll be digging in deeper to the intersection of trauma and neurodiversity. But as is always the case with a series, this will make more sense if you go back and listen to part one first. Okay, here we go. Welcome, Kelly. Thanks for coming back.
Absolutely. Good morning.
So for anyone who either has forgotten since last time or didn't take our good advice to listen to the first episode, will you just do a brief introduction?
Absolutely. So I'm Kelly Smith. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker, have been so for about 35 years now. And my pronouns are she, her, hers. I am passionate, and I guess some people would say I'm an expert, but I go with I'm passionate about the areas of attachment trauma, loss, and grief, and this triple intersection of trauma, neurodiversity, and gender diversity.
Awesome. And so since we're going to spend the bulk of our time today really kind of peeling back the layers on the neurodiversity lens, would you give our listeners just a little reminder about what you mean by that term?
Absolutely. We really have moved on this topic because we still have the diagnosis of autism. However, what we're learning from individuals with autism, or they refer to themselves also sometimes as I am autistic, and we'll talk maybe a little bit about language, and you can reference it back in the first part of the series also. But neurodiversity, what we're learning is that it's a range of diversity that exists in the human neurodevelopment. So we all, whether we want to admit it or not, we all are neurodiverse, y'all. And what a blessing for there to be that freedom. So I have some neurodiversity. Cassie has neurodiversity because every single one of our brains processes, listens, hears differently. Mm-hmm. So let's embrace that difference. You know, neurotypical in our society, in our world, in our schools, and everything is set up in a more neurotypical way. And neurotypical definition really is about people whose neurodevelopment falls within a range, usually considered typical. Well, what's typical?
Yeah, the whole thing.
If we all are neurodiverse.
It's like a lot of words that don't really say much at the end of the day.
And at the end of the day, let's be curious. Let's figure out ourselves. And let's be curious about other people that we're engaging with.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, it really is inclusivity matters.
Yeah.
Not the language or the word or the definition or diagnosis.
So if we're saying on the one hand, neurodiversity is this umbrella term that speaks to the different ways people's brains can develop and present, and we're also saying that there is a particular place to lean in and notice the intersection between that neurodiversity and trauma and gender expression, that triple intersection there, why does it matter to talk about these things together?
That's a great question. I think we haven't been talking about it. We haven't understood. And what we have now are people who have some language for. We have some individuals who say, hey, my experience matters, and I want to be heard, and I want to be counted. So, which leads me to some numbers. Now, I'm not a big number person, and I think numbers are relative, because if we have numbers based on research, then these numbers have been reported to somebody.
Right.
But there's a lot of people's numbers who haven't been counted or reported. So it's all relative. But the fact that we have these numbers says something. And these numbers are from 2021. So a little old, but not that far off. And they're NCTSN numbers. So they're reputable. So 9 in 1,000 children in the U.S. are maltreated annually. So when I say maltreated, I'm talking about abuse and neglect findings. So those are the ones we know about.
Right.
And what we know as social workers is there's a lot of kids who have experienced abuse and neglect that haven't been counted. 1 in 44 youth in the U.S. have an intellectual disability. So those are our kids who have a IEP, who have that determination.
And is that the place where children who are neurodiverse might be getting sort of formally diagnosed and labeled this way?
It could be there. It could be under other health impaired, around sensory integration needs and stuff like that.
Right.
We'll talk a little bit more about sensory needs when we talk about neurodiversity. 1 in 36 children have the diagnosis of autism. So again, that could feed into our school reports, our IEPs and things like that. 1.6 million, notice I said million, youth age 13 plus identify as transgender. And again, those are the brave, brave kids who have put it out there to their community and their world. And 1 in 4, so this one is big for us, 1 in 4 individuals who have ASAD identity, or what I would prefer calling neurodiversity, are also identify as LGBTQIA. So 25% of our individuals who are neurodiverse also identify as LGBTQIA. That's big.
That's huge. And I want to ask a question about this, because I feel like you're absolutely correct. We haven't been talking about, we've been talking about some of these labels, or diagnoses, or even just gender expressions as like siloed parts of identity, right? And so that's why that intersectionality piece is so important that we talked about in the first episode. What do we know about a causal or even correlated relationship between neurodiversity and youth identifying as LGBTQIA? Do we know anything about that?
We are beginning to know some things. And so I am a part of an amazing team of people at Dartmouth. We're a part of the Dartmouth Intervention Trauma Research Center, also known as DTIRC. I'll have some resources available at the end of this podcast for the work we're doing there. And we have a current grant right now. It's a 5-year grant. It's a SAMHSA and NCTSN grant. And what we are looking at is the triple intersection of, and we have world and country, statewide people across the country that specialize in either the trauma or the gender or the neurodiversity. And we've come together to the table to write some articles, to do some training, to do some research. And so we don't have perfect answers yet. John Strang, who is internationally known for neurodiversity and gender, he is very much at the table with us and does a lot of research and writing about this. And we are in the process of also doing some research and writing some articles. So there's a lot to learn. But you're absolutely right. We are siloed. We have been siloed. And even the services and the organizations to work with these kids are siloed. And that's what needs to shift.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, listeners, I'll be transparent. When Kelly and I were talking about how to structure this conversation, it's difficult to even give information on these various topics without siloing, because you have to kind of chunk it out, right, to talk about these things. So we'll commit to you to keep trying to weave it together. And I'm going to maybe try to bring us back to the focus of this episode, this conversation, which is about that intersection between youth who are experiencing trauma and neurodiversity. So, Kelly, where do you want us to start when we're thinking about this lens?
So as we've understood autism in the past, what we've known is that someone has autism. But what we've learned is that it's not linear. It's not all or none. It's not high functioning, low functioning. But it really is this spectrum. And someone who has autism or neurodiversity could have incredible abilities and strengths in emotional regulation or executive functioning, and yet they may really struggle in social differences, or they may really struggle in the processing of language. So it isn't this all or none, high or low functioning. It really is now neurodiversity, and that all of our brains process and learn and take in the environment all differently. And it's about high-level support needs or lower support needs. And at school, I might need and have higher support needs. Yet on the basketball team,
right,
or at grandma's house, or at summer camp, I may have lower support needs.
Yeah, yeah.
And for, again, for us to be curious and to get to know the individual and to ask the questions and to engage with them and be attuned to them and listen what their needs are, there's a lot for us to learn.
And so I think I'm hearing you kind of push us gently, trying to get us out of the, okay, autistic people do this, or high-functioning autistic people do that, and to think instead about people with neurodiversity, people who have autism, whatever language feels appropriate to that individual in terms of what they want to use for how they describe themselves, present with a wide variety and range of strengths and areas where they could use some support, and that is the frame we should be using to think about this, as opposed to like a criteria. I know something about this person because they have this label.
Absolutely. And folks in the world of autism, they will say, if you know one autistic person, you know one autistic person.
Right.
But isn't that true for all of us?
Of course. Well, that's like, the thing I'm thinking, right? This is true for absolutely everybody.
Everybody. And again, we are learning so much, so much from our individuals who are neurodivergent. They're teaching us. They're teaching us about inclusivity and language and curiosity and attunement and, you know, good for them and shame on us.
Right. And we see this even in the DSM. And if you're listening and you're not a mental health clinician or a licensed social worker, you may not be familiar with the DSM, but that, oh gosh, help me out, Kelly. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual. Does that sound right? It's the big book of mental health diagnoses that you use as a clinician. And the autism diagnosis has moved a lot and changed significantly just in the last edition. And I think one of the pieces that we don't think about, you know, culturally enough is that mental health is really fluid. What was a diagnosis in the third DSM is not a diagnosis in the current DSM. And we move things in and out as a society, you know, when we think about them differently. So neurodiversity is definitely one of these topics that we're watching the change happen now, live, in real time.
And I think it's happening pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Because they're pushing us. And I excuse my language when I say they, but people with autism, neurodivergent people are pushing us to say, it's all of us.
Yeah.
And hey, look at yourself. And then Kelly Smith looks at herself. She's like, dang, yeah, I have some. That's me too.
You're us.
I'm us. We're us.
Amazing. So with that as sort of the grounding principle to think about this, in the first episode, we talked about some examples of where the specific intersection between trauma and neurodiversity might be. Like, what are the events that someone who is experiencing neurodiversity might have happened to them that are traumatic? Can you remind us just a couple so we can contextualize kind of where to move from here?
Absolutely. Bullying and exploitation by peers, I think, is a daily matter for individuals and youth with neurodiversity. And I think what's difficult, because some of our individuals do struggle with reading social cues or understanding tone of voice. So what can happen, a kid at school who is autistic, who has autism, notice my language there again, they're walking down the hallway and Joey and Bobby make fun of him and they're laughing. But George is like, oh, Bobby and Joey are laughing with me. They're my buddies. And, you know, I turn around and I give them high fives and then they're laughing more. And what George may not realize is that they're laughing at him.
Right.
And what they said, three other people overheard. So then that continued the bullying and exploitation. And then 3 days later, when George sees Bobby and Joe and maybe goes to give them knuckles, like, oh, we're friends.
Yeah.
Then they're made fun of or pushed into a locker or ignored or things like that. And that that's what's difficult for, I think, so many kids at school. High school is hard enough in middle school to read, are you my friend or not my friend today? But for our kids with neurodiversity, I think it's even more difficult. And I just think of the sadness to realize, oh, they're not my friends.
Yeah.
And or I go home and I tell my mom the story and my mom's like, yeah, that was not nice. Those are not your friends. But mom, they're my friends. We were laughing together. We gave knuckles. And then a month later to not be invited to the party and everybody's talking about it. But they're my friends and I don't get invited.
Yeah.
I think that for me, that's just sad. That's just sad. And I think of my nephew and never, ever, ever invited to a birthday party or prom or homecoming or school dances or, you know, really nothing. And that's sad. And then you have, you know, unfortunately, improper use of restraints. So a kid loses their noodle in the gymnasium because of the sounds and the noise and there's too much going on and they just have this sensory meltdown and someone misreads that or a chair gets thrown and someone misreads that and then this kid gets restrained because they think they're going to hurt themselves or someone else and then that becomes a traumatic experience and being held down and, you know, I mentioned before the medical appointments and, you know, the dentist, oh my goodness, no disrespect to the dentist who might be listening, but going to the dentist.
It's hard as an adult.
That's a thing.
Neurotypical adult here who hates the dentist.
That's a thing for all of us. So then you expect our folks to go to the dentist and they've got this big light in front of them. They've got these weird glasses on them.
Yeah.
And then they got this heavy thing on their chest. And then someone's picking and chewing and picking and putting water in there. I'm telling you, my nephew is losing their noodle to go to the dentist. And so then, out in the parking lot, it's not pretty.
Yeah.
Or I can't go back to school the next day or that afternoon because it wasn't pretty. So those are the kinds of things that our neurodivergent youth experience and families experience. And there's a lot of judgment and blame that is put on parents with special needs kids. And it's like, or at Target, you know, how many times have I had to pick and carry?
Right.
Or they're losing their noodle over the bright lights. But what it looks like is I'm giving in to my kid and giving them the Hot Wheel.
Because we've got these standards, right? These normative standards of what parenting is. We were talking even in the car on the way here, right?
Yeah.
About the generational expectations of how children need to behave in a restaurant.
Yes.
And how exhausting that can be for everybody involved. Yeah. And one of the things I'm thinking about as I'm listening to you, Kelly, is I think we're doing, well, I know that we're trying to use the complexity and be nuanced in this conversation to just model over and over. There's no one way that children with neurodiversity present, right? But I think some of the examples we're talking about are for, might be more applicable or relevant to youth with neurodiversity who have higher support needs. One of the things I've heard a lot about just through the school system and working with educators is some of the challenges that might come with neurodiverse youth who have lower support needs but are working really hard to mask all day long, right? And
yes.
I'm wondering if we could talk about that concept a little bit and how that plays out for some other neurodiverse youth.
Absolutely. So those youth may be incredibly bright, incredibly successful in the academics. They could teach the math class. Because how they line things up and how they can see things and their perceptions, they're brilliant in math or science or writing or something. Yet walking down the hallway and reading that social cue or never wanting to go to gym class.
Yeah.
Never wanting to go to the lunchroom, wanting to go to art, but I'm only going to do what I want to do in art class. So I get an F in art class.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I'm a fantastic watercolorer.
Yeah.
And us not really understanding, well, he's a brilliant student. He gets straight A's. So what do you mean he can't?
Right.
And us not understanding. And that masking piece of, I know enough to know what it should look like. And I try all day long to do that, whether it's stop rocking or stop playing with my hair or
chewing my hair, chewing my shirt.
Or the spinners that I play with or my squeezy things I play with. You know, I'm a junior in high school now, so I guess it's not cool to have my little squishy toy. So instead, you know, I chew in my pencil, or instead I'm constantly gripping my pencil just to mask it because I need my squishy thing, but I can't have my squishy thing. And I mask it, and then I go home or I get on the bus and it's loud and I lose my noodle on the bus, or I get home and all I want to do is sleep.
Yeah.
Because I have just spent the last 6 hours just masking.
Just trying to fit into a world.
Just trying to do it because I can't rock. I can't chew on my pencil. They took my cheese away. You have to listen to the previous episode to understand the cheese story. You know, I'm a junior, you know, I can't play with my squishy toy, but those are all the things I need.
Yeah.
Right now I'm sitting here in the studio and I've got the mic cord and, you know, it's kind of squishy and I'm just playing with it. And that's just what I'm doing.
Yep.
And let me play with the dang squishy cord.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I've seen some interesting movement in that over the last couple of years. You know, so like as a trainer, you know, we'll now have fidgets out.
Yes.
Coloring books, pipe cleaners, squishies, whatever, for adults.
For adults.
You know, not just for kids. And it's lovely to be, I find as a trainer, to be in front of the room kind of doing some type of workshop and have people, you know, soothing in a way so that they can attend to the content and still be regulated. And what a different world it would be if that was acceptable in all spaces, not just, you know, niche social work trainings.
Exactly. Why can't my junior in high school have his little stuff out on the table?
Yeah, for sure.
And not have to mask and pretend to be okay.
There's a huge conversation around later in life adult diagnosis.
Yes. I met a woman yesterday. Professionally, we're working on a project together, and she's in her 30s and shared that she was just recently diagnosed. And all those years of masking and not really knowing what it was, but just knowing that in a professional setting like this, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But then realizing when she would get home how exhausted she was, and finally to have. Not that we want diagnosis, not that we want labels, but it also can be freeing to say, I have a name now.
Or a community.
I have a community. And she was talking about starting maybe some support groups for professional women who have late diagnosis. And that's a whole nother gender thing. We typically see younger boys diagnosed earlier than girls. And often girls won't get diagnosed even until they're adults. And
that's the intersectionality right there.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's some theories about why. And one thought I have about it is that, and this is so gender typing too, though, okay? So girls may be in their room alone reading for hours, right? Or playing with dolls and dressing them and redressing them and their Barbies, cutting their hairs and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Some of the repetitive behaviors.
The hyper-focus stuff.
Yeah, the hyper-focus, repetitive behaviors. The dollhouse has to be just right, da-da-da-da-da. Yet that isn't seen in the same way.
That's a little more gender normative. I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah. Then, you know, my nephew, it was Thomas the Train. And oh my goodness, it was Thomas Train everything. And Thomas the Train was all over the house. And it was easy to see, there's some preoccupation with Thomas the Train.
Yeah.
But not so much with maybe a little girl who's reading a book and who wants to read all of the horse books in the library. So it is quite interesting how it looks different and then how we misdiagnose
based on our society's understanding of gender.
And expectations. Yeah.
Exactly. So, okay. I know that we are starting to run a little short on time. I think that we wanted to talk a little bit about behaviors and how we should view those behaviors when an individual with neurodiversity has encountered something that's difficult or challenging.
So all of us have behaviors, and our kids particularly have more behaviors than language that tells the story. And what I want all of us to really think about is let's notice the behaviors. Let's know they tell a story. There's something about the behaviors, but let's don't focus on the behaviors. And we talked about this in the first episode, so I encourage you to go back and listen to it, because we talked about it more in depth. But really, again, who our neurodivergent individuals are is amazing and unique and strong and creative and courageous and funny and resourceful, and they want to be connected. So yeah, they may rock, and yeah, they may eat the same slice of cheese, and yeah, they might lose their noodle over loud noises in the gymnasium, and yeah, they may tear off their sweatshirt because the seams are bugging them, and you know, when it's a high stress level, they may do some rocking and playing with their fingers, and so those may be some of the behaviors that we see. But really, what we need to see is how amazing and unique and strong and creative and courageous and funny and resourceful they are, because they figured out how to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
Their neurological system and their sensory system is on overdrive, and they have figured out how to take care of that in what looks like maladaptive, but actually it's pretty darn adaptive.
Yeah.
And as we can walk alongside of them and be curious and see them as amazing and unique people, you know, I think it makes a difference.
Yeah. And if you had one sort of request for people who are working with individuals with neurodiversity who have high support needs, you know, what would that be? Because I think a lot of our listeners may have people in their lives who have all sorts of different experiences, but might also be working in roles where they're working with neurodiverse youth in schools, or, you know, neurodiverse youth in the child welfare system, or neurodiverse youth in the mental health system. So is there a main thing you really want folks to think about?
Yes. I have a lot of things I want them to think about. The framework that we talked about in episode one, of really showing up and engaging, that's something I really want folks to go back and listen to. But the other thing I really want folks to take from this conversation is this concept of hope. I want all of us to have hope for the individual. And a couple things I want to say about hope. I've learned a lot about hope. Hope's not an emotion. Hope is this cognitive thinking approach, and it's 100% teachable. And people who have experienced hard times are better at having hope. And hope is a function of that struggle. And this is what I love, I think, the most about hope, is that there are two prerequisites for high levels of hopefulness, and it's perseverance and tenacity.
Mm.
And think about that for our neurodivergent youth. Oh my goodness, perseverance to just get out of bed.
Mm-hmm. To move through a world that
has move through a world, and the tenacity that they keep showing up. That's what I want folks to hold on to. And people who have had hope have had someone in their life that modeled and held out hope for them. And might one of us who's listening today, might we be that person for someone,
mm-hmm.
that we just walk alongside and have hope for them and believe in them and be curious and see them as amazing people.
Yeah, and I know you've really raised up for me some interesting reflection points about showing up as curious, as really sort of the center of that practice, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't assume. Be curious.
Yeah, that's the tagline.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it okay to leave it there for this one?
I'm good.
Okay, well, that sounds like an amazing place to pause here. We will continue the conversation next time and dig into the gender diversity component. So thank you, Kelly.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The Social Work Lens is produced by the University of Vermont's Child Welfare Training Partnership and the State of Vermont. Our theme music is composed and performed by local band Brick Drop, and our sound production and engineering has been brought to you by Egan Media Productions. We'd also like to give a special thank you to our in-house administrative production assistant, Emma Baird. For the Social Work Lens, I'm Cassie Gillespie, and we'll see you next time.